This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is Fashion Week in New York, and the runways feature designs and accessories that can set you back several grand when they arrive in the stores next February. But you can get that same look a lot sooner, and for a great deal less, from Quick Copies. There are out-and-out counterfeits complete with forged logos and labels, which are often hawked by street vendors, and knockoffs, very similar designs with different labels that show up on the racks of stores like ABS and Forever 21. Copycat couture is a multi-billion dollar industry and a controversial one. The counterfeits are already illegal, and Congress is considering legislation to protect fashion under copyright laws. Later in the program, a new documentary on the lives of garment workers who manufacture this clothing, made in L.A. But first, counterfeit couture. Would you buy a fake designer bag or a knockoff of an expensive dress? Why or why not? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Dana Thomas is the author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, and she's Newsweek's European cultural correspondent. Today she joins us from the studios of NPR West, and it's nice to have you on the program today.
It's nice to be here.
So take one of the bags that we're seeing on the New York runways this week. Aimed for the spring collection, which arrives in stores in February. How long before you could pick up a fake one on Canal Street?
Well, probably not too long. They don't put them right away because they would be ahead of the curve. They want the companies to do the advertising first and get that handbag to become an it bag. But as soon as it hits, then you'll find the fakes on Canal Street in New York, Santee Alley in Los Angeles, flea markets around the country, anywhere you find counterfeits.
How does this happen? Where are these knockoffs made?
A lot of them are made in China. And I actually went on a raid in one of these counterfeit factories in China when I was researching my book. I went with Chinese police in a workshop in Guangzhou in north of Hong Kong. And we went with, in a really horrible place in town, and we went up the 7 flights of stairs and burst in and walked in, and there were a dozen children, 8 to 12 years old, sitting there making counterfeit Dunhill and Versace handbags.
This is almost like you describe it as, you know, a lot of people believe this is urban legend that people in China can sometimes sell their children to work in places like this.
Absolutely, or that children make these counterfeit handbags or watches. In fact, the children are hired to do the watches because they have tiny little fingers that can do the mechanics. But, yeah, a lot of people think it's urban legend, and a lot of people think that buying counterfeit or fake goods is a victimless crime. And that was what I saw was not true when I went on the raid. And the other research I did for my book, I learned that counterfeiting the rings that sell the counterfeit goods on Canal Street and Santee Alley are, you know, they're like drug trafficking rings. They're crime syndicates, and they launder money that goes into funding terrorism. They promote and use human trafficking and bring people, you know, in ships and things to lock them up to make the goods.
Uh-huh.
It's a very nefarious world, and so it's not a victimless crime buying a fake handbag for just a few dollars from somebody.
I can believe a lot of nefarious things are done by these gangs. Terrorism.
It's been known that the money from selling counterfeit goods, luxury counterfeit goods, has backed FARC, the army in Latin America, the IRA. That there are even some, they believe that the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 was funded by the selling of T-shirts on Canal Street, counterfeit T-shirts.
Canal Street, of course.
In Manhattan.
In Manhattan, down by Chinatown. And not the fashionable part of Manhattan, let's put it that way. But nevertheless, how do we know this?
Well, some of this, the head of Interpol, Ronald Noble, has talked before Congress about this and said that we must fight this more. And then, you know, the companies themselves go out and try to fight counterfeiting, and they hire PIs. I went around Santee Alley in L.A. And wrote about it with a PI, a private investigator, sort of the Jim Rockford of counterfeit goods for luxury brands. And when we went down the streets, the dealers, they dashed in their stores. They threw down the fronts. They were throwing all their items into trash bags and throwing them out the back door. There were spotters on buildings whistling ahead when we were coming. It was really extraordinary. Hmm. So, you know, they do their research, and they've been the PIs themselves have been attacked by gangs. There's gang warfare over selling counterfeit bags.
And this is a lot of law enforcement gets involved in trying to police this.
Absolutely. And they have to. I mean, the city of New York loses, I think it was several $100 million a year in taxes alone, just because these sales are all done in cash and nobody's paying taxes on them. And then, you know, they're criminals that are selling them. Hmm. And it's going, you know, it's funding criminal activities. And so law enforcement does try to crack down. The problem is that they don't really have any backup afterwards. So often when they do arrest counterfeiters, they're out on the street before the paperwork is done. There aren't the laws to put them in jail. A investigator told me that, you know, you sell $150 worth of heroin on the street, you wind up in jail for 25 years to life. You sell $150,000 worth of handbags on the street, you don't even go to jail.
We're talking with Dana Thomas, author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, Newsweek's European cultural correspondent. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Chris is on the line. Chris is calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was just calling. It's a very interesting show that you have going on. I set up here on the weekend. I was overseas for a while and met quite a few people while I was over there in Europe and Spain, where they have quite a deal with counterfeiting and everything else. And I met people through traveling, and I set up here in on the weekend and sell Nike tennis shoes that I get. Not extremely proud of it, but obviously I'm calling, so I'm not extremely ashamed of it either.
Mm-hmm. And these are counterfeit Nikes with the logo and everything?
Well, honestly, I've never been to the factory, so I don't, and I look at the ones that are in the mall, and I compare them, and I compare the boxes and the SKU numbers and the designs and everything else, and everything is the newest, you know, it's the newest shocks or the newest trainers and, mm-hmm. and all of this kind of stuff. I look at the boxes, the labels. I mean, every single thing comes through. And they had an investigative report here in my city where they had gone around to the flea markets, like she had said, and they had asked different people and things like that. And, you know, people, I think the majority of shoppers that they interviewed, of course, nobody really that was selling really wanted to talk to them. But the majority of shoppers that they interviewed were like, you know, we come to them, and people come to me. I mean, people call me probably three or four times. I have a daily job. I work. I just do it on the weekend for extra money. But people probably call me three or four times a day that have seen me either on the street or whatever, and I've, you know, given them my number, or they've gotten it from friends who are happy or whatever, looking for some sort of shoe because they want it a little bit cheaper than the store, or they want it, you know, here or there.
And I'm just guessing, I don't play tennis, but a Nike's Top Flight tennis shoe could run $140-$150. What do you sell them for?
I sell them, the most that I sell any shoe for is $100, and that's for a top of the line. That's the ones that came out this year were about $175 in the store. They were $174.99, and I sold them for $98. And I, you know, and then another thing that's really interesting, and I don't know if maybe your guest can respond to this, but several of my packages, when they're coming into the States, I order them from the manufacturer. Like I said, I don't know which factory they come from or don't, but several of my packages have been stopped by customs. Customs has opened them up. They've inspected the shoes. They've inspected the weigh bill. They've inspected everything else. Then they've taxed me. They'll look at the number of shoes that are in a box. They'll put whatever dollar amount they think it should be at for proper taxation. They'll tax me when it comes through the I have to either pay the tax or give it up, which I pay it because it, you know, it serves me better to have the shoes here. If it's so much of a problem and illegal or everything else, then, you know, you would think that it would be more agencies would be working together where customs just sends it right on along the way. I mean,
let's see if we get a
I've never had a problem getting a box in the mail.
Let's see if we get a response from Dana Thomas.
That's very interesting. I know that they do try to crack down at the ports when the goods are being imported, or because generally they're smuggled in. And at L.A. Port, for example, they really do try to bust the counterfeiters when they're smuggling them in. They'll put counterfeit handbags inside of big containers that are shipping in frozen food or lingerie or, you know, anything to get it in the country. I think once it's in the country, then, you know, it's in the stream of commerce. Mm-hmm. If he's having him shipped in from China directly...
It sounded like from Europe somewhere, but anyway.
Or from Europe, you know, it's you know, that's customs. It's a vast bureaucracy in there. Mm. But also, it's hard to crack down on them because they don't have the laws to do anything once they do arrest them. Mm. There is a judge in New York who is trying to change that, Judge Grisha. And Judge Grisha has been fining counterfeiters vast amounts of money when they are caught, the Canal Street people, the dealers. And the idea is if they just fine them so much money that it will not be worth their while to do the business. Mm-hmm. And they've been putting liens on their homes and their cars and really just trying to basically bankrupt them. He said that's the only way we'll get them out of business is if we can stop the demand and we bankrupt them.
And Chris, are you expecting to be out on the streets again this coming weekend?
Yes, I normally go out on Saturdays and Sundays for maybe 4 or 5 hours a day. We have a lot of... Here in San Antonio, we have a lot of Mexican national people who come up to shop, San Antonio being one of the closest cities to Mexico. And quite a few people back to school was a really good time. And, you know, I don't mean to gloat, and I completely understand a lot of what your guest is saying or a lot of what a lot of people have said about money laundering and everything else. Like I said, I have a daily job, and one quick note. I do it on the weekend. I pay my cell phone bill with it. I don't drive anything fancy. I buy gas with it, and I buy groceries, and I don't drink or smoke. You know, all of it, and maybe they just taxed mine because my shipments are so small, because I'm just a small individual person. But every single penny that I make, and I see a lot of other people that are out there, maybe not with Nikes, maybe with other things, like she said, handbags. And I see so much of the money just going right back into the community or back into the infrastructure. Maybe it doesn't go back in as taxes.
All right, Chris.
But I mean, a lot of people, this is their income.
Chris, thanks very much. We appreciate the call, and good luck to you. We'll have more on Knockoff Couture when we come back. This is NPR News. Our guest right now is Dana Thomas, author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. And she's with us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Gabrielle. Gabrielle with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you said, would you buy something like that? I wouldn't buy either the original or the knockoff. I think it's just a symptom of our silly, shallow society that people would spend thousands of dollars on a stupid handbag or dress or pair of shoes or anything like that.
Yeah. So you would not buy either?
No, I wouldn't buy either. I wouldn't waste my money. If I buy a piece of clothing that has some brand name on it, I'd prefer to cut it off.
Hmm.
Plain old, simple, workable. I mean, who needs to spend that kind of money for a silly, frivolous handbag when there are so many needs in this world?
Well, clearly, in terms of need, nobody. But in terms of people who want to, well, Dana Thomas, this is a huge business.
It's a gigantic business. The luxury fashion goods business today is $157 billion a year in sales.
Mm.
And that said, the counterfeiting business makes up for 7% of our global trade today. Everything from baby formula to Ferraris. They actually counterfeit Ferraris now.
Mm.
The worst, of course, is medicine, but one of the biggest is luxury goods. And the reason it's such a huge business is because the luxury goods legitimate business has been advertising and marketing and selling $157 billion a year in sales and just so much that there's the demand that they can't meet and people can't necessarily afford those logos that have been marketed so much that they really, really, really want to have. And so they're buying fakes and passing them off as real. The fakes, mind you, are getting much, much better. In the old days, you know, you bought a fake Rolex on the street, and by the time you got to the corner, it wasn't working again. And it looked plastic. But today, they take the real things, like a real handbag. They'll take it apart. They scan it on a computer so they have a perfect pattern. And then they know the sourcing of many of the materials, or they can reproduce the materials really well. Mm-hmm. And then they sew it back together. It looks like a perfect replica.
In fact, there was a story in the Washington Times about Chinese hackers, gangs of hackers, breaking into the computers at places like Gucci and Prada and places like that. They're not bothering to take the garment or the bag apart. They're taking the design right off the computer.
Right off the computer. Yeah. Gucci does all their designs on computers, and they zap it back and forth between London and Florence and the factories. So why couldn't somebody else just cut right in there and get it? Exactly.
Mm, yeah. Let's get Barbara on the line. Barbara with us from Goose Creek in South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi.
My father-in-law used to sell what we call gray goods, anywhere from Guess to Mickey Mouse, even Coca-Cola, and some of the national football leagues or the football teams in the high school, not high schools, but colleges. We got into trouble a little bit, but when I looked at them, I justified the fact that we were selling these goods. Ours were made in the U.S., and they were better quality than what we did see that were knockoffs. And what was really funny is that now it's gotten to the point where it's so big, it is so huge. One of the places that we did, the flea market up north, you see it on every end cap of the row. And it isn't just Americans, it's Chinese, things of this nature, where I didn't feel really totally embarrassed about selling them because I knew that they were of better quality than what we saw in the stores.
In terms of T-shirts, she may have a point, Dana.
Absolutely. And in a lot of things. One time I was in Hong Kong with a Swiss watch expert, and he took me on an experimental trip to buy a fake Rolex. Hong Kong have really cracked down. The Hong Kong customs officials have cracked down on selling counterfeits in the streets, so it's very hard to find them now, though it's still out there. You have the guys in the doorways going, Rolex, Rolex, Rolex. So we went and followed one of these guys, and we went up through some dark alleys and back stairways and through a steel-reinforced door, that, and we had to have a password, and we get in, and what do they sell? Fake watches and fake handbags.
Hmm.
And we negotiated the price from $150 for this fake Rolex down to $40. And the Swiss watch expert bought it. And when we left, he said, you know, it would take someone from Rolex in Switzerland to say that, to ID that this was a fake watch. And even so, it was a darn good watch for $40.
Here's an email we got from Jose. Why don't police act when they see people selling fakes in places like flea markets? I sell legitimate brand name shoes in the Kansas City area. I pay taxes. I have a business license. There are a lot of vendors who sell obvious fakes. Police come by and nothing happens. Is there an organization or a website where you can denounce this? And Barbara, I wonder, what would you say to somebody like Jose, who makes his living selling legitimate items and pays all those, inconvenient fees to places like Disney for the Mickey Mouse logo and stuff like that, and he says you're driving him out of business. I guess Barbara's left us. What about Jose's last point? Is there an organization or a website where you can denounce this? Can you help him out, Dana?
Well, yes, of course. The Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition in Washington is fighting this. This is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Homeland Security has a website and a hotline called Stop Fakes. And you can find that very easily by Googling it. I think it's just called Stop Fakes. It might be 1-800-STOP-FAKES or something like that. And you can call in and denounce it. The problem is, like I said before, there are no penalties. The penalties are very, very weak. You know, in the old days, 20 years ago, if you got caught selling counterfeit goods in New York, you got a $2 fine.
Mm.
I mean, it was less than a parking ticket. It's a bit more than that now, but not much. And they can't hold them in jail, and they can't put them, the only way to put them out of business is to put them out of business, as opposed to putting them in jail, because they don't have the laws to back them.
Dana Thomas, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Dana Thomas, author of Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. You can read an excerpt at our website at npr.org/talk. She's also Newsweek's European cultural correspondent and joined us today from our studios in Culver City, California at NPR West. Amy LaRocca is a contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of the New York Lookbook, a gallery of street fashion. Today, she joined us from NPR's bureau in New York, and nice to have you on the program with us.
Hello, nice to be here.
And also with us is Cal Raustiliana. He's a professor of law at UCLA. He wrote an op-ed in the New Republic, How Copyright Law Could Kill the fashion industry. He's with us today from the studios of NPR West. And Mr. Rastiala, nice to have you on the phone today.
Thanks for having me on the program today.
Amy, first, as the laws stand now, we were talking about counterfeits in terms of putting a YSL or somebody's logo on a bag or something, clearly against the law. But there's no law against taking inspiration from somebody's design and putting your own label on it.
Right. Well, certainly if you're going to knock off a logo or a very specific thing, that's protected at the moment. But what isn't protected is a design in general. So you can make a very, very, very close copy of a dress and sell it for whatever you like and not be in any trouble at all. And, you know, slap a different label in there.
And we have this email from Keith in San Rafael, California. He says, I can see the illegality of buying a logo or a trademark or a recognized pattern like Burberry, but how does somebody copy a style, pattern, or trend in clothing? Where do we draw the lines and who draws them?
Well, I think this is what the question is at the moment, and they're working on an act right now. Chuck Schumer and Jerry Nadler and a few other people are, along with the CFDA, which is the Council of Fashion Designers of America, which is called the Design Piracy Prohibition Act, which is to protect what is really the intellectual property of a fashion designer who's spent 6 months in the studio sourcing fabrics, doing research, and creating a dress or a coat or a pair of shoes and is extremely frustrated that this is now being knocked off so quickly and in a lot of cases turning up in shops before the original even gets there.
And nevertheless, Rustiala, you say this is in fact something that's vital to the fashion industry, that these inspirations create trends and trends create, well, fads, and that's what we all live on if you're in the fashion industry.
Well, that's right. I think one of the things about fashion that's so obvious to all of us who look at it is the nature of the trend and the fact that trends are really what fashion is about in many respects. And when you ask yourself, what is a trend? You know, the answer is usually a trend is a series of things that are somewhat similar. So when we say that dresses look a particular way or this type of shoe is in style this year, what we're really saying is that there are many different offerings in the marketplace that share some common theme. They're variations on a theme. So part of the concern with this bill and the idea that we ought to protect designs is that it might well squelch the ability for trends to develop.
The fashion industry, at least in New York, Amy LaRocca sees it very differently.
Right. Well, I think what Cal said is somewhat similar, and I think that's what a lot of designers are finding troubling, is that things are becoming not so much somewhat similar any longer as direct knockoffs, and that's what they're finding very hard to stomach, is seeing really, really indistinguishable versions of their own clothes in mass chains, you know, at a much lower quality and a much lower price.
And before their dresses are even in the store.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, the way the industry's changed is, you know, I'm going to go to a show at 4 o'clock, and by 5 o'clock, you can go on NewYorkMagazine.com and you can see that show. You can see everything right away. And so the speed with which the clothes are going from the runway into the consumer's imagination is instantaneous. And that's giving the knockoff companies just they can get to work. Mm-hmm. They can get to work tonight if they'd like.
And is that not unfair competition, Cal Rustiala?
Well, I certainly recognize the harm that accrues to certain designers, and I know people personally who have had that experience, and it is frustrating. But I think you use the word competition. I think that's a very important word to bear in mind here. In the United States, we use intellectual property law as a means to spur innovation and creativity. The notion is we want to create incentives for creativity. And I think the issue with fashion is that we see an enormous amount of creativity. As Dana Thomas mentioned earlier, it's an enormous business. It's a growing business. It's doing very well. And so there isn't really a huge need to spur more creativity. So one of the problems with the bill is, with this proposed legislation, is that it's really fixing a disease which is not very very severe. Mm-hmm. And it's potentially creating a larger series of problems because the language of the bill, and this goes back to a point that Amy just made, there is a difference between what we might call a point-by-point copy and something that instead draws inspiration from another design. But there's really, two problems. One is the difficulty of identifying what's original in fashion. It's very hard. The second problem is that the way the legislation is written and the way copyright law traditionally handles these issues is it uses something called a standard of substantial similarity. So it doesn't ask, is it exactly the same? It asks whether it's substantially similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is when you inject that into a realm like fashion, you're just going to create a sort of legal morass with potentially just a flurry of lawsuits, lots of business for lawyers, no doubt. But I don't think it's particularly good for consumers or for the industry.
And let's get Amy, let Amy get back in there.
What I was going to say is that this, you know, the sort of precedent we have for this is a case that happened in 1994 in France, where Yves Saint Laurent sued Ralph Lauren for showing a tuxedo that he considered to be substantially similar to his original Le Smoking, which he showed in the late 60s. In the late 60s, when Yves Saint Laurent showed The Smoking, it was a kind of a revolution. Women weren't wearing trousers, certainly not as evening wear. When Ralph Lauren showed it in 1994, the context was entirely different. And it could be argued that there were a lot of tuxedos that looked quite a lot like that for women mm-hmm. in 1994. Nonetheless, the French court, I mean, of course, it being France and Yves Saint Laurent being Yves Saint Laurent, you know, he won. And Ralph Lauren had to pay Yves Saint Laurent something because...
$400,000.
$400,000, yeah. Which in the terms of the business that those two men have, not a lot of money, but it was sort of the spirit of the thing that, yes, you know, he did knock off a moment.
Hmm. We're talking with Amy LaRocca of New York Magazine and with Cal Rustialia, professor of law at UCLA. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is David. David with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Big fan, listen to your show every day.
Well, thank you for that.
And something that I was just curious about is how much of the responsibility goes on the actual designer. When people, they see these designs, they love them, they want to buy them, and so then the designer says, okay, well, I can make millions of dollars by charging $250, $300 on a bag, $200 on a pair of shoes. Well, how much?
I think you're being really light on those prices, but go ahead.
Well, the t-shirts that I wear come in a pack of three, so I haven't been shopping for designer things in a while. But I'm just curious as to when these things come out and they charge such a large amount of money for them, how much responsibility for these knockoffs go to the actual designer? Because if I can go out and I can get a pair of shoes for, $50, $75 off the street as opposed to going to the store and getting it for like $200, $300. I mean, how much responsibility actually goes to the designer and these big corporations?
Well, I think actually what you're paying for is not only the design and the integrity of the design when you buy a luxury pair of shoes or a piece of clothing or handbag. You're also paying for the quality. And certainly the quality that you're going to get from a luxury company is going to be very different than you're going to get in the knockoff. So the fabrics are going to be different. The fabrication is going to be different. So it's not just the design you're paying for. You are paying for a higher quality good. So it's not, you're not getting the same thing.
But partly you're paying for that label. Partly you're paying for that exclusivity.
Label.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're paying for the expertise, the creative vision of the person who is, who's created this.
But if that person is willing to pay the premium price for the Yves Saint Laurent, whatever it is, label, shouldn't, as Cal Rustialia says, why shouldn't somebody else be willing to pay a third the price, a quarter the price for something that says Smith on it instead?
They can, but it also can't. It can't be the exact same idea, which is, I think there's such a, in fashion, there's always the art and commerce question in fashion, and I think it is a commercial art, definitely. But I think this is a moment where you have to look at the art side of it and understand that these are designers who work very hard and are talented and creative and well-trained and well-studied and that their designs do count for something.
Hmm. David, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for taking it.
From Samantha in Grass Valley, California, when I heard you introduce this program, my initial reaction was that I would not buy a knockoff that was claiming to be an original, but I would have no problem buying a copy that was admitting to be a copy. Are the ethics really different? We'll discuss that when we come back and talk about this some more with Amy LaRocca of New York Magazine and Cal Rustialia, a professor of law at UCLA. I think I got it right that time. We're also going to be talking about the situation of some of the garment workers who manufacture these clothes in appalling conditions made in L.A. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about copycat couture. These are knockoffs of well-known designer labels that can sometimes appear in the stores of places like Forever 21 months before the fashions arrive in stores for the spring collections. We asked early in the program, would you buy a copy, and if so, why? From Janice, I would buy it if it was a one-time only reason for a special occasion. However, I do believe it's wrong, and I would be especially affected if it was my livelihood. From Carolyn, it's like buying generic drugs. After all, that's the only kind of drugs that my insurance will approve, never the brand name. Thank you. Our guests are Amy LaRocca, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, and Cal Rousty-Alla, the professor of law at University of California, UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles. I'm going to mess up something with your name. I apologize for that. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Stephanie. Stephanie with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi. I was just calling to ask if it's really the same market that they're talking about, because the amount of people who have access to Gucci and Chanel and Yves Saint Laurent, they can spend a couple grand on a bag or $600 on shoes. If it's the same market, that someone who could buy that would actually go and buy the knockoff.
Yeah, presumably Mrs. Fauntleroy would not be caught dead with a pair of knockoffs on her feet. Does she have a point, Amy LaRocca?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a different market. Although, you know, but I think definitely you're talking about two different markets, but I think what the designers are hoping is that they are going to be designs that are inspired by what they've done rather than directly copied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really a difference. And it's two different markets, absolutely.
The thing is, I shop at Forever 21. I'm a young college student, and I don't see a problem with it because I don't think that I cut into their market share at all.
Mm-hmm. So if you don't see this as anything unethical, so you're going to go right ahead with it. I mean, it's certainly legal. I'm not going to argue.
I don't have a choice because almost there's only so many options out there stores out there, and almost everything is a knockoff nowadays, it seems like.
A lot of designers are also sort of addressing how much fashion has started costing with secondary lines. You have any number of designers have done lines for H&M that are extremely affordable. Karl Lagerfeld, Stella McCartney, Victor and Rolf. So there is an attempt by the fashion industry, however small, to address how expensive clothes are and to make good design available at different price points. But I think what the designers have take issue with is the direct copying of their work.
Thanks very much, Stephanie. And let me ask you, Cal Rousty-Alla, you make the point that it's really hard to define what's original, who came up with what first, and what's inspiration, what's homage, and what's an illegal copy. Yet in the music business, not precisely analogous, but in the music business, this whole business of sampling, they've arrived at a way to figure out what part of so-and-so's copyright goes to so-and-so whose song they borrowed.
Yes, that's right. But let me just go back to something that was just said. I think one of the problems in the discussion we were just having is an assumption that the elite designers are in fact the originators. And often they're not the originators. What they sometimes do is they mine the past. They go back and they look at collections from other designers, maybe famous designers, maybe less famous designers, and they bring those designs back. Or what they often do is they look to the street and they see what people are wearing, and then they somehow reinterpret that. So if you really wanted to sort of pose the question of who's the originator, you'd have to do a lot of digging. And I think in the end, you would find that it's not always the Guccis and the Chanels who are originating designs.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. But I think, again, it's a question of interpretation rather than direct copying. But direct copying from vintage pieces has come up in high fashion over the years, definitely.
Sure, but it poses a great difficulty. It's one thing to have the situation we have now where we understand that somebody references something from the past or perhaps gets inspiration from the street. But it's another to say that that person can use the law to obtain a monopoly over that design. And that's really what we're talking about when we talk about copyright protection. We're saying that the government's going to step into the marketplace and provide a monopoly to that individual who claims control over that design. That's very powerful, and I think we just need to bear in mind that, that's going to change. That's going to change the marketplace quite a bit. But Neil, to go back to your question about music, I think there are some similarities. There are some differences, I think there's a cautionary lesson about music, which is that if you look at the case law that's out there about music copyright infringement, you'll see that many songs, not just samples, but songs that have similar melodies, mm-hmm. have been held to be illegal because they're infringing, even though I think you and I and most people would agree they're really not at all the same song, and we can pretty quickly tell the difference.
Well, the one that everybody remembers is He's So Fine, and,
exactly.
and then the George Harrison My Sweet Lord. The tune was very, very similar.
It's very similar, right? But you would know that they're different songs, and I think that's a cautionary lesson about how that kind of standard of substantial similarity, it's the same legal standard, might be applied in the fashion context. So you might end up with, again, to analogize from that those two songs, two dresses that share something in common, but have many, many other things that are very different about them. And they nonetheless might be held, one might be held to be infringing the other. And, you know, Amy's point has been we want to keep the point by point, the exact copy from occurring. But that's not really what the proposed bill that Senator Schumer and Clinton and others have put forward. That bill would do something very different. It would be much more like the music example.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, and want to thank you both for taking the time to be with us today. You just heard Cal Rausdiala, a professor of law at UCLA. He joined us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for being with us and for putting up with my stumbling over your name.
You're most welcome.
And Amy LaRocca, contributing editor at New York Magazine, author of The New York Lookbook, A Gallery of Street Fashion. She joined us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk next about the people who manufacture the clothing that we've been talking about.